Blog Talk Radio.
Thousand feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. Rain together for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the leaves to drop.
Welcome to the African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club. I'm your moderator, host Charles Williams, and I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jalavette. Say hello, Jalavette.
Hello, Jalavette.
Well, we're all working our way through this one, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I'm very surprised at how far we've gotten. I think we're on chapter 7 now, right?
Right, right. We'll be through before you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very interesting chapter, I tell you. He, Ms. Frederick Douglass, lets us in on, you know, his state of mind, how he was, how reading, learned to read and comprehending the arguments of the abolitionist.
Mm-hmm.
He had to open his mind and it's inside of him that which... that light that would spoil the slave as his new master, new overseer, new tormentor, devil incarnate would come to pass. And that's exactly what happened after reading several essays written by abolitionists of the day. This is probably around the 1830s. And it would give him the motivation to fight for his mind, because that's what he had to fight for when he eventually was sent back to Colonel Lloyd's plantation and or some other plantation, I can't remember, but when he, from when he made his escape, is that he had to, they had oppressed his mind so, with so much hard labors and anxiety from torments, beatings, and other kinds of horrors, that he talked about actually becoming brutish like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this happening to our people in our time, being made brutish by seduction.
Right.
Right. And our, the people are not, don't have the cognitive function that of humans anymore. We're slowly being transformed into the caliber of modern technocratic system of humiliation.
Well, not only that, you also have the food, media programming,
right?
Environment, chemical warfare. From, you know, there's an onslaught from many different directions.
Right, atmosphere, weather, pollution.
Right.
Right. All these things. The destroying home life, community, making us destroy the community ourselves.
Exactly.
All these things those things weren't available in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, you know, onward, until they developed them. Then, as Dr. Amos said, they could take the chains off of us.
Right.
We no longer need. It was no longer necessary to publicly lynch us downtown on the courthouse.
That's it.
In the courthouse trees to teach us.
But while keeping in mind that the lynchings are still happening.
Oh yeah, it's still happening. Right. They don't have to lynch us that way.
They don't have to lynch us that way. Right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's interesting. I'll read a little passage here for you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We'll start on page. I'm going to go to. But he mentions here on 305, the beginning of chapter 7, how he didn't have a regular teacher, and his mistress, who had kindly began to instruct him, what she did was she started it, but her husband dissuaded her from doing it, which we read that in chapter 6. And it got so bad that she started basically harassing him about his behavior around the home, meaning that if he was sitting quietly somewhere, she wanted to know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
To be certain that he wasn't learning, he wasn't still keeping up to the business of studying.
Because,
mm-hmm. Matter of fact, he mentions here right here on 306. He says she at first lacked the depravity indispensable to shutting me up in mental darkness. It was at least necessary for her to have some training in the exercise of responsible power to make her equal to the task of treating me as though I were a brute.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that she had just got in on this whole, you know, black oppression game, and she didn't, you know, she just, this was, he was the first person who had, first African who had been under her power.
Mm-hmm.
And why she learned that, knew to learn that she wasn't supposed to teach him to read or allow him to read and all that sort of thing. But she was just wasn't as good at him, you know, not keeping him from being able to do it successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And this is amazing. He talked about this transformation in the previous chapter about how she, you know, she had this demonic expression and she had the indwelling upon receiving the evil instruction. And he says, my mistress was, as I have said, a kind and tender-hearted woman. And in the simplicity of her soul, she commenced, when I first went to live with her, to treat me as she supposed to one human being ought to treat another.
Mm-hmm.
in entering upon the duties of a slaveholder, she did not seem to perceive that I have sustained to her the relation of mere chattel, and that for her to treat me as a human being was not only wrong, but dangerously so. Slavery proved as injurious to her as it did to me. See, when I went there, she was a pious, warm, and tender-hearted woman, and there was no sorrow or suffering for which she had not a tear. She had bread for the hungry, clothes for the naked, and comfort for every mourner that came within her reach. Slavery soon proved its ability to divest her of these heavenly qualities. Under its influence, the tender heart became stone, and the lamb-like disposition gave way to one of tiger-like fierceness. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So upon, he's saying he's seen a person go from not knowing about, you know, what's this, you know, how does one keep a Negro under control? And, you know, she's trying to, you know, she's been married to this family, and she is of European descent, and it's part of her duty to her culture to maintain. She's not saying, oh, I'm going to do what's right, under, you know what I'm saying? So I'm saying that we have a heavenly duty and a social duty, and hopefully your social duty is in line with what the creators want. In this case, we've seen what the Americans or the European corporate European decided to do was they going against the creators, they're going against the Most High by carrying out this plan of dehumanization, humiliation, and it has proven detrimental to their I would say their social consciousness, to the you know, I think we talked about the loss of their humanity.
Right.
Right. That's what he said. He said it proved injurious to her as it did to me.
Right. So essentially, she was that was taught out of her, basically, how to treat him, what we would now call humanely, that had to be corrected.
Right.
Right.
And now, I mean, the machine is just, they grow up, like we talk about the media, how it affects us, it also affects them too. Today, I think Taj Pono, the guy, he talked about how he don't see a black person from Africa and a black person from America. He said, oh, they're just different. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he subconsciously, he just get it from the programming, from the way his relatives relate to, you know, Negroes when they see one. And he's learned it since he was from his smallest age, you know, from his smallest age, youngest age. So when he encounters foreign or one that is not one of our own Negroes, as they say, you know, they consider us their property, because
mm-hmm.
we are under their power, and you don't get out, you don't not become their property by some legislation. You become your property when you're able to emancipate yourself in the fullest extent. I'm not talking about ransoming yourself, which is what we've been doing.
Right, and it's what they did. They had to buy their freedom.
Right.
And so to buy your freedom from someone is then to admit that they then are the holders and purveyors of freedom.
Right.
We talk about that all of the time. We give them so much incredible power.
Right.
You know, over basic fundamental truths in our lives.
Right.
You know, they went over and kidnapped people in a flesh trade system to build wealth, and then had the audacity to charge us, you know, to only semi-freedom, because there still was no real freedom. There still is.
Right.
No real freedom.
I mean, right, yeah. Let's make a simple allegory, parallel. I kidnap somebody walking down the street, and I sell them to my brother.
Right.
That person said, I want to get out of here. Well, if you're going to get out of here, you got to give me the money back that I paid my brother.
Right.
Then I'll let you go.
Right. They are the level of the evil. It is evil. It is a really a systematic structure, evil structure.
Yeah, it's been inbred and embedded into their consciousness.
And just like we talk about our ancestral memories, I don't understand why that concept is so difficult to understand when we're talking about ancestral memories for them as well.
Right.
We're just speaking about it, about the young man on the show that said that for some reason he just sees a difference.
Right.
That's, he's drawing on an ancestral memory.
Right. As well as his cultural, social, all of it.
Right. Right.
His ancestral memories have taught him how to feel about what he's doing, and they've taught him it's okay.
Right. Right.
It's okay. There's no problem. It's, you know, don't worry about it. Don't, you know, it'll be all right. They deserve it. Look at them. They need us. You know, I was reading Exodus chapter 1. Well, I was getting ready for a program on that, and it talks about how the 19th dynasty, the Aramean dynasty of Egypt, was discussing amongst themselves how they were going to keep Israelites there, and they said, hey, you know, we can't afford these people to leave.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want them to rise up and leave us, but we don't want them to be powerful while they're here. We want to be, they want, they were saying they want to benefit from them being there, but they wanted them to stay. And some reason our people can't understand the science,
mm-hmm,
in that chapter. They can't, you know, we don't know how to network, we don't know how to socialize, we don't know how to, I mean, it's like all we know how to do is prey up on one another.
Yeah.
And we feel that we have some kind of right to victimize the other, because we think the other one is, you know, we think that's what it is. That's normal.
Well, you know, we're not by ourselves though. You know, every other nation understands, and it's just common knowledge outside of our community that we have been fattened for the slaughter. Other nationalities come in and prepare our hair care products. They set up grocery stores. They set up, you know, alcohol stores and very all of our basic needs. The fish fry, and they set up these things and they come in and they, you know, take our money.
Right.
And we are, as you know, as a nation of people, we're talking about the African in the Americas, we spend several billion dollars a year.
Right.
And so because we don't produce much, certainly not much in the way of, you know, export, because we produce very little, then we have a wealth of resources,
mm-hmm,
that everyone else understands that they come into this community and get it, including now, you know, African people have the beauty supply stores and stuff now. That isn't just, the Koreans or the, you know, Vietnamese doing the nails or whatever. It isn't just, you know, that community anymore. Just about every community understands that this is where you come and you set up businesses, and what you need to do is you set up your business where you treat us like prisoners.
Right.
Put up the bulletproof glass, and, you know, there isn't a whole lot of upkeep necessary on the buildings and stuff. It's, you know, very low maintenance, and you follow us around, you know, hurry up and buy. That's just understood.
Right. I mean, when, you know, they set up merch shops in their own community, they don't do that.
Nope.
I've been to some of those Korean markets, and you know what they have? They have pictures of people who they suspect of having shoplifted posted in there.
Mm-hmm.
Humiliate, you know, the customers and all that sort of thing. I mean, it's just, I don't know why. Well, I do know. We know why people continue to go in there and spend money. They think they have to go buy their product. You know, I think we really want to. We want, basically, the black community is committing suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we've said that, and they just we're just doing it very slowly.
Yeah.
You know, it's just very, very slow. Matter of fact, I have a quote here from the wisdom of Sirach, or Yeshua. It's interesting. He says, a rich man begins to fall, is held up by his friends. This is chapter 13, all right, verse 21. A rich man was beginning to fall, is helped up by his friends. But a poor man being down is thrust away by his friends.
Mm-hmm.
When a rich man is fallen, he has many helpers. He speaks things not to be spoken, and yet men justify him.
Right.
The poor man slipped, and yet they ridiculed him. Fussed at him. He speak wisely and could have no play. I mean, they don't invite him to hear his wisdom. So when a rich man speak, every man hold his tongue to keep their mouth shut and look at what he says and say is great and lift it up to the clouds. But the poor man speak, they say, what God, who is this? If he slips and falls, they will help to overthrow him, push him over, take everything he has. And riches are good unto him that has no sin, and poverty is evil in the mouth of the unrighteous. So the whole point is this ancient wisdom of this ancient Hebrew. He told us basically what the black community is dealing with now.
Right.
The collectively, we're poor. We're the Sudras. We're the Dalits. We're the untouchables of the American Anglo-American caste system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you want to know why we behave like this? This is the science found written in this book over 2,000 years old.
Right.
This is the psychology. And until we decide that we don't want to be this way anymore and to do the right thing, which is, you know, we talk about teshuva, repentance, and that sort of thing. That's the only way. You have to turn from do a 180. From the way we think, we talk about thought pattern, change, transitions, and these sort of kinds of behaviors, which Dr. Amos Wilson talked about. Frederick Douglass talks about it here.
I was going to say, Frederick Douglass was just speaking of that.
Right.
He's talking about the transformation of our mind, our thoughts.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness is bad.
Right.
It's really cognition, the way we relate to each other, even in the one so-called enlightened people.
Mm-hmm.
Just as bad as people who don't claim enlightenment.
Right.
Who don't claim consciousness.
Right.
Is not superior.
Right. And that's unfortunate. I think it becomes sort of redundant. Because we can sit and talk about what's wrong, what we shouldn't do, this, that, and the other, and then we can flip that and we can talk about, well, here's what we should do. But there's so much, and sometimes it just seems greater than maybe something that we can accomplish on a grand scale. However, if we each would look at our own lives and what could be changed in our own lives, it could make a resounding difference. And it could be something as simple as respecting one another.
Right.
Because we do have an issue with the greater, weightier matters like investing in ourselves or seeing ourselves as worthy, of this type of investment, what we could do is just take care of just those around us, just our family, our home.
What is that? That's loving your neighbor as yourself, the second greatest commandment.
Right. It could be just simple things, which are difficult for us. They're difficult. We're facing a time right now, this week alone. I've seen several stories go by, from the young lady on the bus to the woman in Atlanta that accosted the rapist of her son, or alleged rapist. I don't really know the story. But anyway, just I'm seeing it just seems more and more frequently situations where we are attacking one another when, for example, with the situation with the elder on the bus, there was disrespect. There was disrespect on both ends. But what happens is the men will look at it and say, well, she hit him and she spit on him and, you know, this and that. And he was driving the bus and he almost wrecked it. And so, you know, he should have struck her and that's great. And then they just factionalize. They just see that and they just go with that. And so now it's that's the male perspective. And then the female will say, well, you should never hit a woman and it doesn't matter what she said or what she did, you know. And so then she's saying, no, the male is wrong, and the male is saying, no, the woman is wrong, and so now we have become divided. Now, it doesn't take much, we have to admit, it doesn't take much for us to divide against ourselves.
Yeah, because we're already divided. We can just divide more.
Right.
Into smaller pieces.
Exactly. And so, for some reason, we're having difficulty looking beyond the obvious. And that is that there is a mutual lack of respect.
Right, it's mutual. And with
horrible.
With no desire to repent.
Right, it is horrible that that man hit that woman like a man. It is horrible that he lost control of himself and did that. But it is also horrible that this young woman would step to her elder that way.
Right.
So it is, you understand what I'm saying? So we can't see beyond the us and them, and they've turned us so perfectly against one another that some of the most simple and basic fundamental human truths like respect and honor, these types of things, we can't even do that for one another.
No, we can't.
You see, and that is the part that always frustrates me. You know, with the situation with the young lady out in Atlanta who, you know, cut up this coach, I mean, cut him to pieces. Now she's going to, you know, quite possibly serve, you know, some time in prison. Maybe not. Maybe she'll get, you know, can do an insanity thing, she snapped, whatever, I don't know. But the point is, something as simple as that, when you just look at it, the emotionalism, we get involved very quickly as a community. We get very emotional, and we're very reactive.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so much emotional. We don't think about how we're going to feel.
Right, and so we look at that situation, and we say, that's right, that woman did the right thing because she, you know, and I agree that in any family situation, any species of mother, you just don't mess with the cub. You just don't do that, right? Because the mother will go off. However, my question in that situation is, where was the dad? Why is it that she had to take care of that hands-on herself?
Well, you know, that's...
No, I know what you're going to say. We don't have to get into that. But I'm saying, of course, there was a better way. That's all I'm getting at, is there was a better way, but not in our community because we don't have a community that takes care of things for itself.
But yeah, that was what I think you thought, you know, but what I was going to say was that's how he targeted his victim.
Oh, yes, of course. Those pedophiles and stuff, they target single moms, yes, absolutely.
Right, with sole custody of the child.
Right.
Or limited, where the father has limited access to the father.
Right.
Is a pedophile, sexual predator's dream.
Dream child, right, because she's going to be looking for that male figure, and, you know, he's going to be right there, you know, to help you out, and, you know, and help himself, you know, to your child. That is what they do. They do profile.
And the female sexual predator usually goes undetected.
Oh, absolutely. That's like a whole nother issue.
Right. I mean, it's the same issue.
Right. The point that I'm getting at, though, is that we lack some of the very basic and fundamental ideas of what community really is, or let me just say what community could be.
It's all a survival issue. I mean, we're talking about community, you're talking about survival.
Right, we're talking about survival, right.
So we don't know how to survive. And I made a statement, I said we don't really think about how we're supposed to feel. And that requires, I'd said that, but I was like, that's not natural.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way we have to respond, it requires, we're supposed to be programmed to understand what's best for us and be able to have that instant response that's in our best interest. But being that we've been programmed to not function in our best interest, we have to actually sit there and think about it all hard.
Right.
Black folks have to do that.
Right. We're not in a position to just act naturally. Right. We are in a very bad situation, and we do have to think differently, sometimes unnaturally, so that it will be to our exclusive best interest, and I don't think that we're interested in doing that.
Right, and this is in every area of human activity.
Right.
I mean, not just in a crisis emergency situation, but we have developed an appetite.
Mm-hmm.
An appetite to cannibalize off of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
And until we get rid of that flavor of our own flesh.
Our own blood, that's it.
And that's the problem, in my opinion. And many people say, yeah, I don't know who they're talking about. Well, whatever. They can say what they will, and everything will continue going on as it is. You know?
Right.
It doesn't matter who thinks I'm right. I can look at what's going on, and so can they. Everybody sees. Everybody does. Nobody wants to change. Very few, rather. I don't say nobody, but very few people want. We've known that before we started this, project. But that's it. And all of this could be minimized. That's why like them say they take the chains off of us, because we're broken now. And now they can openly have rhetoric about, how slavery is good for us now.
Right. Wait, right.
They can
just say that openly now.
Openly. That's why they got mad at Joe Biden. Biden came out and said, hey, they're going to put the chains on you, and they took the mic out of his face.
Right.
And then they started pumping Clinton, and, Clinton, and it's like Clinton was running for vice president, or he was running for president, and Obama was his running mate. And because he brought up the slavery issue in a realistic manner to basically warn black folks, hey, they're going to put some chains on you. And then you had these two other guys, politicians, who I posted up in African Conversations, and his other guys, some Republican guys. They all was politicians, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
One said, the Bible was cool with the way the Europeans do slavery.
Mm-hmm.
He just said slavery was fine, blah, blah, blah. No, it ain't. What Europeans do is kidnap people. Now, that's not cool.
Right.
Right. And they tried to say that it is. And he had this other guy say, it was a blessing to. He didn't say to whom it was a blessing, at least the quote that I saw didn't say. But whatever, they get over to talking about what they're doing. They saying these Negroes is weak. We got them.
Right.
Yeah, they helpless. We got more of them in jail than we had on the plantation in 1850. Now we can just ride through the neighborhood, and we can just pick up as many Negroes as we want and just take them home with us. That's basically what they're saying.
Right.
And they can.
Right. And the unfortunate thing is that it's not necessarily by force, because many of us are jumping in.
Oh, yeah.
On the bandwagon asking for a ride, holding our thumbs out. Lord,
they came through your neighborhood with us and said, hey, come go off to Master Kittler House for a good job, three meals and a cot, that truck will be full. And they'll leave and never come back and say, I'm glad I'm getting out the hood.
Right.
Right. We're worse off than we were 150 years ago.
And that is scary.
That's why we do this program, because we're worse off.
Right. If you just listen to Frederick's account, how he's talking about basic, fundamental, very, very rudimentary ideas of preservation. when he's talking about learning, not for the sake of learning or learning to get a good job from Massa, to get a promotion on the slavery line, you know, up the slavery scale, you know, he's not talking about that.
No.
Talking about liberating his mind.
That's right.
You see. And so that's not happening now. That's not happening in our institutions of higher learning. We were learning better in the barn.
Right. People now, if you read, they always trying to figure out, like, if you're studying a particular subject for your own personal interest or whatever, and they discover your research, they'll say, ooh, wee, you trying to make a lot of money? You trying to get a job? Everything you do is supposed to be geared toward getting paid.
Right.
That's how obsessed black folks are with dead presidents. Fiduciary assets.
I know what you're talking about. I know. All right. So where do we, you want to go to the next
section? Yeah.
Or do you want to take a break?
Okay, let's take a break.
All right, let's take a break. I want to say greetings to everyone listening live on the browser, those in the chat room, and to our callers. If you're interested in being a part of this discussion, you could give us a call at 323-580-5707. Otherwise, we will be right back.
Listen in to African Conversations on the African Knowledge Network, where we will converse with researchers about matters significant to the African diaspora community. Join us on Facebook on the African Conversations community page. Enjoy the dialogue on African Conversations on blogtalkradio.com. Listen to Love in Black with Charles and Jalavet on the Tribal Family Station on blogtalkradio.com.
There we will share our experiences and our insights on marriage and love, sex, respect, and honor. We're on every Thursday evening on the Tribal Family Station.
My name is Eric Deemer, host of Common Sense Conversations. Join me every Tuesday and Friday when I put common sense where it ain't so common. That's Common Sense Conversations every Tuesday and Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Common Sense Conversations on blogtalkradio.com.
Join the Woman Song Community Experience every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com. We will do the thing that many think cannot be done.
African Knowledge Beyond the Book appears every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are a literary society dedicated to the study of African-based psychoanalytical texts. We hope you will join us as we delve into the inner working of our African consciousness. African Knowledge Beyond the Book, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com.
Welcome to AfricanImpressions.com. African Impressions is a black-owned business that offers products made by the global African community. African Impressions offers the finest in African-made jewelry, craft, clothing, and so much more. As the renaissance of the African community rapidly approaches, you need to add acquiring products crafted by members of the global African family to your repertoire of activities. We must rediscover more of our ancient cultural habits, which we struggle to regain, and incorporate them into our daily lives. Support African craftsmen and women by shopping at AfricanImpressions.com today. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to the African Knowledge Blender Book Club. Tonight's feature is a narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. We're in chapter 7 of his autobiography, taken from the anthology of slave narratives, published by Library of America, edited by William Andrews and Henry Louis Gates. We finished a discussion about Frederick's mistress stopping him or enforcing her husband's law on no reading of her captives, and what effect that had on him, and how it affects our community today,
mm-hmm.
and how we don't want to awaken our minds and emancipate our minds and free from this, I would say, this brutish, cannibalistic way of thinking, and until that we make a 180 degrees, a transition from the path that we're taking, basically make a bow face turn from everything that we're doing as a group, and do the opposite. Do like George Costanza said, the opposite day. I'm saying, Phil, have to be start doing the opposite of what the way we operate.
Mm-hmm.
But as human beings, we've been conditioned, thoroughly conditioned, bred, and indoctrinated to behave this way. And until we want, desire something better, different for ourselves, the problem will persist and intensify.
Right.
And that's it. There's no other way to see it. I mean, everybody's free to determine for themselves what they will. And with that, we've just given our opinion here. And I mean, this is a very riveting to read. This is a brother who's dealing with it, and he's like sharing what his thoughts were at the time. I mean, this is the most awesome genre of American literature that is so understudied by our people. I mean, we don't even read these books as a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are basically the scriptures of the American experience for black folk.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do, we cast them aside just like we do all of our ancient sacred writings. We consider it insignificant, and we think it's outdated, outmoded, irrelevant, and obsolete. But based upon what we're trying to do, it is obsolete if you're trying to keep your mind free.
Right.
Nice. This is interesting. He says on page 307 how he planned to oppose her restrictions. He said, here he is at the beginning of 307. He said, the plan which I adopted and the one which I was most successful was that of making friends of all the little white boys whom I met in the street. As many of these I could, I converted into teachers. With their kindly aid, obtained at different times and in different places, I finally succeeded in learning to read.
Mm-hmm.
When I was sent of errands, I always took my book with me. And by going one part of my errand quickly, I found time to get a lesson before my return. I also used to carry bread with me, enough which was always in the house, and to which I was always welcome. He had access to some food, so he can don't pay poor children with food. Mm-hmm. And he said, for which, he said, I was better off than the other children in regard that than many of the poor white children in our neighborhood. This bread I used to bestow upon the hungry little urchins who in return would give me what more valuable bread of knowledge. I am strongly tempted to give the names of two or three little of those little boys as a testimonial of the gratitude and affection I bear them. But prudence forbids, not that it would injure me, but it might embarrass them. And he goes on to give the address and everything and no circumstance. But I'm gonna fast forward down here. He said every opportunity he got, he spent reading. And one particular book he read was called The Columbian Orator.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he read it all the time. And he said among much of the interesting matter, he found it a dialogue between the master and the slave. And the slave was represented as having run away from the master three times. The dialogue represented the conversation which took place between them. When the slave was retaken the third time, in this dialogue, the whole argument in behalf of slavery was brought forward by the master, all of which was disposed of by the slave. The slave was made to say some very smart as well as impressive things in reply to his master, things which he had the desired, though unexpected, effect. For the conversation resulted in the voluntary emancipation of the slave on the part of the master.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I went throughout it and say, you know, he searched his knowledge out, meaning the knowledge of literacy. He devised a means to acquire instruction. And upon getting instruction, he found good material to read. Come on. How many of us, people in our community, we talk about reading material that we would say is not beneficial to their well-being or to their mental improvement?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have people spending time reading, you know, pornographic literature, better known as romance novels, and watching, they go to school, learn how to read, and spend hours watching television and playing video games. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, we do everything that we can to not improve our state of mind, to not improve our condition. We aren't concerned with it, you know. So, I mean, that's fair to say.
Right.
And, I mean, here he is. He's reading books that are, you know, challenging his mind to understand the arguments for what are people saying to justify their behavior, their culture, economic, capitalist basis. And he's learning. He's 12 years old. At the time of this, that he's documenting this, he's studying rhetoric. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Most people ain't studying rhetoric until they get to college.
Right.
But he's studying rhetoric, the effect that is the effective use of language, to basically think his way out of being a captive. Now, we read in Harriet Jacobs' work, Harriet's younger brother didn't have to go and do all this. He understood it, you know, through a different new means, you know, and he ran away as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, our people were fixated upon improvement of our station in life, not just for the sake of bragging, because we wanted the basic God-given right to be free. And they, although they, at that time, freedom was the most they could attain for. Now, we dropped the ball in trying to obtain sovereignty. And what I'm not saying we have dropped the ball because we have not attained sovereignty. I'm saying we dropped the ball because we're not working towards it.
Right. And that's the difference.
That's the difference. We're not working on it. We just sat down on the plantation and say, hey, this is it. They've given us a few more creature comforts. They just, you know, laid some fresh pine wood in our cabins.
Right. We're getting our education in the hopes of being higher up on the slave chain.
Right. night. You know, they put a fireplace, they put beds in the cabins now. Hey, we got insulation. Everybody has cookware. You can plant a garden. We can have our own livestock supply. I mean, we can eat meat. We ain't got to always, you know, eat that weighed out, doled out portion of food that they was giving, you know, giving back. Then we read that in chapter 2.
Uh-huh.
You see, so in other words, it improves things a little better. Like I said, just enough to keep us comfortable. And the point is, Frederick, in this chapter here, in chapter 7, he's more comfortable than he's ever been in his life. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And he's not sitting around saying, well, this is pretty good. I got it so much better than I had it on Colonel Lawrence Plantation. If I can just live out my days here, I got it made. That's not what he's talking about.
Right.
He's still trying to improve himself so he can even escape this level. He realizes it's just levels. See? And our people have gotten, and I guess you want to make to relate that to our situation, is we've got to this home and we've sat down and said, "Ooh, this is good here. I'm just going to sit down here. I ain't going to do nothing to mess this up because we got it made." And that's where the full spectrum of black society is right now. We've sat down and we said we have it made because we're not interested in putting the work in to change our or improve our manner of thinking. We don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at each other and saying, "Hey, you know, I got a better house than you. I'm living, you still on that plantation. If you was trying to stop worrying about trying to get free and reading all them books worrying about sovereignty and just, hey, you could be eating these nice fried chickens and corn cakes and sleeping on a real bed." See, all that them, y'all talking about y'all wasting y'all time.
You did it so authentically.
Oh, yeah. A lot of practice at hearing that.
Well, all right.
You know? So, you know, we've got to understand that. And this is what Frederick Douglass is describing right here. He's describing his tenacity to push onward. And we don't have that anymore. Black folks don't have it. We've lost it. It's long gone. I'm going to add another quote here. He says, "The bread that he used to bestow upon the hunt," well, I read that part. He says, "I'm strongly tempted to give," I read that too. Hold on. He says right here, I want to read this. He says here, blah, 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 blah. He said, "Not that I would," he said, "but he wouldn't embarrass those people, for it is almost unpardonable offense to teach slaves to read in this Christian country. It is enough to say to of the dear little fellow that lived on this street that he used to talk about slavery." Now, he talked about slavery with white folk. See? And they were at that time were apparently showing compassion for his plight.
Mm-hmm.
The children who was teaching him how to read, who he was exchanging bread for, because they were more destitute than he was, they showed compassion. I'm looking at a relationship here is, yes, there was cruelty on the part of the nation, and yes, there was some compassion on the part of the nation. And we were more tenacious people at that time. And look at us 150 years later, 200 years later, what are we now?
Mm-hmm.
They're more relentless. Now, they're more unrepentant now, and we are more forgiving, and we don't have the tenacity. I mean, we want to dismiss all of the wrongs they've done. We're not trying to push on, and they don't give a doggone, and they care about maintaining the impression and increasing it. And that's why I read that little section to read to really demonstrate that. And this is a very awesome chapter, and I hope that you would spend your evening reading this if you haven't acquired the book by now. That's a crying shame. And from your local library, because every library in America ought to have it. If your local library doesn't have it, that it is owned by some hideous group that doesn't want you to read about slavery or something. I'm just thinking of something bad to say about
it. Okay. All right. Well, it was nice.
That's good. And next week we'll pick up on Chapter 8. You know, we'll just we'll do this again next week.
All right. Peace.
Peace out.